Again, I might, quote a bit from here in the same way.
So, after Jordan, what was your next war? Which war did you attend next?
The next war was the Indo-Pakistan War, which was in December 71. But if I can just give you a bit of background to it, it didn't actually... the reasons for the war started much earlier. Yes, the war, so-called Indo-Pakistan War, which was very short-lived, began and ended in December 71. The reasons for it began much earlier. If I can just recap, there was this enormous flood in what we now call Bangladesh, but in those days was called East Pakistan. People will remember that Pakistan was in two bits, West Pakistan, Karachi end. Then you had this 1,000 miles of India separating what was East Pakistan. The capital was Dhaka. The West Pakistan is always, who are really almost a different race altogether from the East Pakistanis, considered the East Pakistanis to be an inferior people, much smaller, much different in culture, different in attitude, but they shared the one religion. And it was any religion, really, that kept them together. Nothing else did. And when there was this enormous flooding, in which hundreds of thousands died, the reaction of the West Pakistanis to this disaster was such that whatever love, whatever unity the two parts felt for each other was demolished. You can imagine the dismay, the despair of the East Pakistanis, the Bengalis, when the leader of their country couldn't even be bothered to fly 1,000 miles to see the devastation and the wretchedness and the suffering for himself. He said he was too busy. You can imagine the effect it had upon the Bengalis when the West Pakistanis couldn't even send helicopters to search for people, to lift people out of the water, even though there were helicopters already in East Pakistan. They never left their pads. You can imagine the effect it had upon them when food that was sent by the international community to Karachi for onwards flying to Dhaka never left Karachi, or when the few bits arrived in Dhaka was never properly distributed. Most of it was purloined and sold on the black market. So it was that was the final wedge that was to separate the two countries forever. And out of this came a protest movement led by Rahman, Sheikh Mujib Rahman, and he formed the Awami League. And he wasn't really a radical, he was a very ambitious politician, but he formed this Awami League and was determined to create a far more autonomous East Pakistan. But he went a step too far. Instead of letting it evolve, and I think probably the West Pakistanis would have been happy to have kind of offloaded a bit of their responsibilities to him, he went hell for leather for independence. And that was something the West Pakistanis would not put up with. Because Pakistan and India are always on tenterhooks with each other. There's always tension, and there still is. And one of the ways of containing India was to have East Pakistan, because if there was ever a war, India would be fighting on two fronts. So it was necessary to keep East Pakistan as part of Pakistan. So when Sheikh Mujib Rahman decided on his little independence venture, Ayub Khan, who was then president, General Ayub Khan, decided to crush them, and crush them they did. And I think I wrote at the time that what was to ensue and what I witnessed was in many ways equal to, comparatively speaking, because the numbers weren't so great, obviously, but or anything that Stalin did, anything that Hitler did to the Jews, and anything, certainly, that Pol Pot did to his own people in Cambodia. The West Pakistani army went in to East Pakistan with one purpose, and that was to destroy it. That was to destroy all opposition. I found it very... I tried to get in to East Pakistan. I went to Karachi and I waited 10 days there with my cameraman. Going to the Pakistan International Airways office every day saying, you know, I want a flight to Dhaka. Sorry, the flights are full. Couldn't make it up because there was a flight every day, a big Boeing going to Dhaka. It was a shuttle service. You know, and how many people want to go to Dhaka every day? But they said, no, the flights are full. So just out of curiosity and kind of indignation, I went to the airport one day, and there were the Boeings parked up in the bays with their engine cowlings off, doors open. I thought, well, they are flying. So the ticket office clerk is not telling lies. They are, but, you know, who are they full of? Because the airport itself was virtually empty. Now, as it happened, with hindsight, I realized that I should have stayed at that airport a little longer that day, because as I left in my taxi to go back to the hotel, within an hour or so, perhaps less, lorries were leaving the army barracks full of soldiers dressed in as civilians. And they were being flown out in a kind of undercover, covert way to Dhaka to begin the genocide. And that's why the flights were full. Thousands of troops were sent day by day into East Pakistan, and the murder began. And it was absolutely devastating. When eventually I did get there, it was virtually all over. Nobody was allowed in. The country was closed off. And nobody knew, you see. Nobody knew what was happening, because all radio contact was stopped. When I got there, what I remembered of Dhaka, you know, half of it hardly existed. Buildings had been destroyed. All Bengali offices, the local administration, had all been demolished. The newspaper offices had all been blown up. The Awami League offices, of course, were totally razed. Anything and anyone that had anything to do with Sheikh Mujib Rahman was either in prison or had been murdered. Rahman himself was in prison. We thought he'd been hung, but he hadn't. I said, it was all summed up by the way Ayub Khan and Tika Khan, who was the military governor of East Pakistan, they called the Bengalis mosquitoes. I've forgotten the local name for it, but they called them mosquitoes, who, like a mosquito, buzzes and is irritating, so you must crush it until it bleeds. And that is how they describe what they were doing to East Pakistan. They are mosquitoes that must be crushed until they bleed. And so East Pakistan was bled to death.
Where did you stay when you were there, Mike?
Of course, the Intercontinental Hotel. And that, too, of course, became... Once we were in there, we couldn't get out. The airport was closed, of course. And all communication was stopped. And I managed somehow to get the first of my films out. I'm trying to recollect the chronology. But little by little, of course, the Bangladeshis, the Bengalis, as they were then, I mean, well, Bangladesh was only whispered. The room boys And people who knew you to be a journalist would whisper to you, Joy Bangla, which means, you know, long live Bangladesh. But it was only a whisper. But little by little, we began to discover that there was resistance. Although Rahman was in prison, all the people, all the young men who had fled the pogrom, who'd managed to escape, formed their own army. And they called it the Mukti Bahini. And the Mukti Bahini became quite effective. It was a guerrilla movement, a bit like the Viet Cong in Vietnam at the time. And they formed their own little guerrilla army. And they began to sabotage, blowing up railway lines, ambushing army vehicles on the roads. And wherever I went, you know, I can remember on a ferry crossing one of the rivers there, which were manned by the army. And I remember a man coming up close to me, because he could see I was a European. He didn't know I was a press man. And he said to me, you must watch carefully, you must see everything. Please tell the people what is happening outside. Please tell them what is happening to us. And I remember writing in my diary, I felt as a journalist must have felt moving among the Jews in Nazi Germany. People could just whisper things to you that, of course, very hard to believe that it was happening. But we were getting enough information. Oddly enough, the Mukti Bahini, obviously, there was a few Bengali journalists in their ranks, started to produce an information sheet, you know, a very crude, typed out, ronioed information sheet, which was being distributed very secretively. I remember, you know, you'd come back to the hotel room and you find that your bed had, you know, been made up, and under the pillow was the information sheet. There were lots of ways in which it was being distributed to you, and they simply outlined some of their successes and the casualties. All of this was denied by the Indians, by the Pakistanis, of course. But the Mukti Bahini became quite effective. I couldn't believe how successful they were, because there was no way of verifying it. But later, when the war ended, you know, you realize that they had in fact been pestering the West Pakistan army pretty effectively. Well, then, of course, it came to a point where the Bengalis' appeals to the outside world to help fell on deaf ears. The United Nations made a few noises, Britain made a few noises, the Americans made a few noises. But I remember writing at the time that whereas the United Nations and all these other countries would get terribly uptight about a single crime against humanity, you know, the crime that was being committed in Pakistan was so huge that nobody appeared to care a damn.
You mentioned genocide, really, and it was on that scale.
It was on that scale. We didn't know it at the time. What you came across, I mean, you came across the evidence of what was going on. I wrote in my book that you would see mounds of earth in villages, you know, new mounds of earth. And you only had to kind of scrape the top of the dirt with your foot to discover a skull or a human bone. You wondered when you were motoring along the roads, when you crossed a small river, why there was such a terrible stench. And if when you stopped and kind of looked, you found in the rushes and in the corners of the river, you could see the rotting bodies. I mean, to put it very crudely, you wondered why the dogs, which are normally skinny and starving, were panting in the sun, you know, full, having gorged themselves on human bodies. You saw all this. And one day, smuggled to me was a roll of 8mm film, which I didn't know at the time contained the actual filming of a massacre of over 200 students at the university in Dakar. It was a long shot, shot by somebody very secretively from the building. And out there on the sports field were 200 students, boys and girls, all lined up. And the machine, they just simply machine gunned them down. You saw them just all falling. And there was this one boy that just simply refused to go down. And even you could see his body being hit, just stayed there until he eventually collapsed. And when we visited the university, the Pakistanis had obviously done their best to kind of clean it up. But you could see the bullet holes, and you could still see every here and there the smear of blood. And they eventually discovered 20 or 30 heads on the roof. Bodies have been decapitated, and for some macabre reason, they'd carried these heads to the roof. So there was evidence that there had been slaughter, but one didn't realize until much later the scale of the slaughter.
Had there also been, was there evidence of rape?
Oh, yes. The rape is part and parcel of every war. Again, it wasn't until much later that we came across the evidence. Because it was only when the war was over that we came across evidence of what had happened. But the Indian Army later, when the war was over, came across the bodies, and in one of the bodies was obviously a Bengali journalist who'd been killed. But inside his clothes, they found his notebook, and they eventually deciphered notes that this journalist had written. And he talked of a young mother who had been hiding with about 50 other villagers in a village in a jute field, trying to hide from the Pakistani army patrol as it went by. And he said that one young mother had a six-month-old baby in her arms who began to cry, which would have given the game away, and they'd have been discussed. So she strangled the child to stop it crying. There was another story that he'd written of an old man who'd hidden his two teenage daughters in the jungle and was carrying food and water out them during the night to keep them away from the army. But somehow the soldiers heard of this and had been told that they were very beautiful young girls. And they conned this old man into believing that there was now an amnesty and everyone could return to their villages unharmed. And so the old man stupidly went and brought his daughters out, who were then gang raped by the army, and the old man was forced to watch it. And once the girls had been raped, the army cut off their breasts. And I think one of the most ghastly stories that was recorded, and these stories, I believe, have to be true, because this young man had obviously been present, and being a journalist had wanted to record it. And he tells the story of the Pakistan army wanting blood because for their own wounded soldiers. And so again they conned the Bengali villagers to give blood, and said they'd have preferential treatment and they'll be given food and protection if they gave blood for the wounded Pakistani soldiers. And so they were forced to lie down, and the needles were inserted into their veins, and they were literally bled dry. I mean, that is the cruelty. And it was astonishing. I mean, I can't believe it even today, all these years on, 30 years on, that the West Pakistanis and people like Ayub Khan, Tikka Khan, and the rest were not brought in front of a war crimes tribunal. To this day, you know, their record is clean, and yet this is what they did. The other part of the story before the war began proper was the exodus of Bengalis out of Bengal into India, into Calcutta. They all fled. There was nowhere west for them, east for them to go. So they all had to flee west past Jessore, across the Indian border towards Calcutta. Incredible lines of people that stretched, you know, as far as the eye could see them to the horizon. I mean, we have in our vocabulary, television vocabulary, a thing called the tracking shot. And that is, you put the camera on the front of the Jeep or the car, and you drive, and the camera just films. And we went mile after mile after mile until we just stopped filming. You know, it just went on for too long. There, you know, young men carrying their old mother or their old father on their shoulders. When they couldn't carry them any further, they simply dropped them and left them to die. People, you know, exhausted, just sat down to die. People carrying what they could on their shoulders until they got too much of them and just simply just dropped what remained of their home and carried on. And I remember there was a astonishing end on one of them. There was a woman, a girl, she couldn't be more than 14 or 15, and she was sitting just below the road. The roads were built up high because of the flooding, the monsoons, and most of the roads were built up. And she was sitting down by below the level of the road, a kind of drainage ditch, and she was cuddling, caressing this, cradling this little boy. He couldn't have been more than three, but he was so skinny, you know, his face was, skin was stretched, his eyes were bulging, the usual symptoms of starvation, bloated belly, and his legs were as thick as my thumb. And she was trying to, she'd got some rice, which she boiled rice, and she was pushing it into his mouth, and because he was so dazed, she was kind of manipulating his chin with her hand, trying to make him eat. And he just looked at her totally puzzled. We were filming this, and finally he swallowed, and then he died. And this mother almost impassively held him for a little longer, and then she opened her legs and dropped him beneath her feet and just covered him up with mud. So that was the kind of suffering that was going on by those people who'd escaped the pogrom, the genocide. Well, obviously this was too much. I mean, Indira Gandhi, who was Prime Minister of India then, partly because she couldn't face the prospect of hundreds of thousands of Bengalis coming into her country, possibly out of indignation, possibly because she wanted to get rid of East Pakistan and the sore that it was on her eastern flank, decided to enter and fight the West Pakistanis, and the war began. I forget the exact date. It was mid-December. Began in a very strange way, in a very kind of lackadaisical way. I think it was Henry Stanhope of the Times wrote that he was taken on the Indian side of the war and was given tea and cucumber sandwiches as he was being briefed by the Indian officer. Much the same kind of attitude was on the Pakistani side. You must remember that an awful lot of the West Pakistani officers, senior officers, as well as the Indian senior officers, had all gone to Sandhurst. They all knew each other. Probably all played golf at some point or other at Camberley in Surrey together. All spoke with this terribly, terribly upper-class English accent. And I think they must have been, you know, a kind of feeling of disbelief that they were actually fighting each other. But fight they did eventually. I remember we went... forget the exact part, but we were flown to Camilla, that's it, by helicopter, where the Pakistanis had tanks. And we thought, great. I was with Jacques Chalençon, the French cameraman, and we thought, fantastic, because there's nothing like a tanks to excite the television audience and us. And we started filming, following these tanks as we were moving, and all of a sudden, waff, you know, suddenly it was artillery coming in, shells landing. And, you know, I was still fairly new to war. This was 71. It was in my second or third war. And I'd been so used to, so accustomed to thinking that if you were being fired at, you could actually see somebody who was firing at you. But, of course, artillery is being fired from 10, 12 miles away. But in they came, these shells. And Jacques and I ran into a culvert to try to hide. But there were Bengali families already in there, and they tried not to let us in, but we pushed in. I think they felt that, you know, two white men coming among them was going to actually bring the shells on them. But we sheltered there for a while, waiting for our tanks to fire back. But all we heard suddenly was their engines, the big diesel engines revving. And they were turning around and, you know, scarpering off. So we got out and ran after them and leaving the shells behind. I remember getting back that evening into the hotel and feeling very brave that we'd survived our first artillery shelling. But we were to see more later. And I think the following day we were shown some Indians for the first time. They'd been captured. They were obviously scouting. We weren't allowed to film them, and the reason was pretty obvious. They'd been very badly beaten up, and they could hardly stand. Either their toenails had been pulled off or their genitals had been electrified. But they were in a very, very bad shape. But we were shown, and we were allowed to film, papers that had been found on them. And the papers clearly showed plans for a concerted Indian attack. So we knew that the war was really starting in earnest. And the war on the ground was not as severe, in my personal terms, as the war in the air, because the Indian Air Force had some very good Sukhoi jets and a very good air force. The Pakistanis had not been able to bring their aircraft from West Pakistan, so all they had was some pretty decrepit old Sabre jets in Dhaka, which were no match for the Sukhois and were soon blown out of the sky. I remember on one occasion, the intercom was quite a tall hotel, and we heard the aircraft around us, so we raced up 20-odd stories up and looked in the sky for the aircraft, and they were below us. They're actually coming along almost at street level. Quite incredible. I mean, it was unbelievable. Quite unbelievable. The Sukhois were hitting the airfield, hitting the barracks, hitting the police stations with great accuracy. And we had this astonishing adventure of, because they were coming over regularly about every 15 or 20 minutes in close formation, half a dozen of them. And we would just stand out in the car park of the Intercon Hotel, just waiting for them. And they would come towards us because we knew they weren't hitting the hotel. We knew what they were firing at. We felt safe. We could actually film them coming. We could see their cannons firing and their rockets being released, all on film. And then we would rush out after they'd gone to film the damage and come back just in time for the next attack. It became so monotonous that we stopped doing it. Quite astonishing. But then there was one evening, I remember, we were woken up at night by the sound of aircraft, heavy aircraft, bombers, excuse me, and we all rushed. There was quite a press contingent there. John Humphreys of the BBC was there. It was his first foreign trip. Don Wise, the wonderful Diane of the Press Corps, Daily Mirror man. Gavin Young of the Observer. There were some wonderful characters there. And Americans, of course, American crews. We all rushed up to the roof. Couldn't see it. It was a very clear night. I remember it was a bright moonlight. Couldn't see the aircraft there, just droning above us. And I remember somebody saying, I think it may have been Don, because he was an ex ex-Second World War guy, he said, this is what they used to call a bomber's moon. That's where the bombers would use the moonlight to find their target. And I think Jack Shaughnessy, my cameraman, said, are they going to bomb tonight? And I don't know who it was, a voice here. No, they won't be bombing tonight. They're just looking. But they'll be back. And, of course, they did come back the following night.